In the last episode of this podcast, I discussed the destruction of the First Temple in 586 BCE and the exile of several of the elite families of Judah to Babylonia. There they settled and apparently thrived. When the psalmist sang, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither," the intent was almost certainly polemical. His compatriots were making a nice life for themselves in the fertile plains and sophisticated cities of Babylonia, and within a generation may have forgotten quite a bit. Nevertheless, when the chance came, and it would be soon, some of these exiles would forgo the comforts of Babylonia for the uncertain hardships of a return to their ancestral home. In this podcast, I will discuss the first attempts to return to the land of Israel and the building of the Second Temple. This episode covers the years 539 BCE to 516 BCE, a mere 23 years, and focuses on the remarkable careers of three largely forgotten men, Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, and Joshua. Theologically, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian ruler under whose rule the First Temple was destroyed, could hardly be blamed. As I discussed in the last episode, the destruction of God's house was seen as having happened according to God's will. Because the Israelites and their ancestors had sinned, God brought destruction upon them and the temple. Yet the idea that Nebuchadnezzar was an agent of God, fulfilling God's punishment of Israel, clearly rankled the sensibilities of the Israelites. The compromise was ingenious. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians were not going to be punished for destroying the temple. That they did only as agents of the God of Israel. They were, though, going to be sorely punished for their arrogance. Instead of realizing that they were simply God's agents, they thought that they themselves were responsible for conquering Israel. It was this arrogance for which God would punish them. The end of the Babylonian Empire came swiftly, an event that could only confirm the Israelite community's belief that their God had not abandoned them. In 552 BCE, Cyrus the Great, the Persian, began his ascent. His first military campaigns were swift successes, freeing Persia from the rule of the Medes. After a few other campaigns, Cyrus decisively defeated the Babylonian army in 539 BCE. The Babylonian Empire was now in Persian hands. Cyrus died about 9 years later in a battle against the Scythians. In addition to his military prowess, Cyrus was politically savvy. We possess one very important archaeological witness to this savvy. A cylinder with a long cuneiform inscription was found under the walls of Babylon. It was part of a foundation deposit. Foundation deposits were commonly made at this time. They are texts and objects buried within a building or a wall and were thought to bring divine favor and protection on the building. Now known as the Cyrus Cylinder and in the British Museum, this inscription justifies Cyrus's overthrow of the Babylonian king and goes on to discuss his support for allowing those peoples displaced by the Babylonians to return to their homes and for rebuilding their destroyed temples. The move, of course, was shrewd. Cyrus had nothing to gain by continuing Babylonian practice. To the contrary, by allowing exiles to return home and rebuild their holy places, these repatriates would view Cyrus as a pious savior. Like all rulers, Cyrus had two primary concerns: that his empire remain peaceful and that its residents remit their taxes in full and on time. In addition to fostering these goals, the policy also was meant to create loyalty among those who were conquered by the Babylonians, which in turn might help them against the hostile or at least suspicious native residents of Babylonia. While the cylinder does not mention the Judahites, its testimony supports that of documents that are preserved in the Hebrew Bible. The book of Ezra opens with a similar proclamation. "Thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of those among you who are of his people, may their God be with them, are now permitted to go up to Jerusalem in Judah and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is Jerusalem. And let all survivors, in whatever place they reside, be assisted by the people of their place with silver and gold, with goods and with animals, besides freewill offerings for the house of God in Jerusalem. Is this the actual historical proclamation of Cyrus? It is hard to know for sure. Given the substance of the Cyrus cylinder, it is at least somewhat plausible. But the text is in Hebrew rather than Aramaic, the Semitic language similar to Hebrew, which under Cyrus had become the lingua franca of his empire. It also contains a few details that seem unlikely: the devotional language to the God of Israel, and the order that local residents give gifts to the returning Judeans are suspect. Scholars, for the most part, think that the substance of the proclamation is accurate, even if in its present form it is a later Judean creation. The account in Ezra continues immediately with what transpired. The heads of the families of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred, got ready to go up and rebuild the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. All their neighbors aided them, with silver vessels, with gold, with goods, with animals, and with valuable gifts, besides all that was freely offered. King Cyrus himself brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. King Cyrus of Persia had them released into the charge of Mithridat, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And this was the inventory: gold basins, 30, silver basins, 100, knives, 29, gold bowls, 30, other silver bowls, 410, other vessels, 1,000. The total of the gold and silver vessels was 5,400. All these Sheshbazzar brought up when the exiles were brought up from Babylonia to Jerusalem. In a scene strangely parallel with the Exodus from Egypt, the Babylonians load the Judeans with gifts as they get on their way. Unlike that supposedly earlier narrative, though, in this version the people are more willing. Rather than the Hebrews asking their neighbors, as in Exodus, the king commands it, and the people seem to comply quite willingly. More important, though, is the notice that Cyrus gave back to these returnees the implements of the first temple that had been plundered by Nebuchadnezzar. The detail is important, for it confirms the legitimacy of the second temple, now equipped with the same holy implements used in the first. The leader of this return from exile, Sheshbazzar, is one of the more significant, obscure figures in the Bible. The implication of this passage is that Sheshbazzar, a prince, is of royal lineage, perhaps a descendant of the king Jehoiachin, who, you might remember, was exiled to Babylonia in 597 BCE when he was only 8 years old. According to Ezra 5:14, Sheshbazzar was actually appointed governor by King Cyrus. He would thus have been the Persian functionary in charge of the province of Yehud, or beyond the river, as it appears to have been known. We don't know anything about Sheshbazzar's activities or whether he succeeded in establishing the Second Temple. Ezra tells us that the second wave of returnees, whom I will discuss momentarily, found that the foundations of the temple were still under construction. But elsewhere, the narrative suggests that not even the foundations were built. Sheshbazzar just literally disappears, and even the ancient historians did not quite seem to know what to do with him. The doubt in the minds of the ancient historians themselves can be seen in the book of Ezra chapter 2. After telling us in chapter 1 that Sheshbazzar would lead the exiles back to Jerusalem with the temple vessels, chapter 2 goes on to give an extended list of those who returned to Jerusalem. According to this account, 42,360 people, not including the slaves, return to Jerusalem. Chapter 3 then opens with an account of an assembly that occurred in the seventh month, led by Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel. Here's the problem. Read quickly, it would appear that this assembly occurred very shortly after the return of Sheshbazzar. It does not indicate any chronological distance. This, though, is almost certainly wrong. We know from the prophets Haggai and Zechariah that Zerubbabel and Joshua are to be dated to the second year of Darius's reign, that is, apparently, 522 BCE, 17 years after Sheshbazzar's return. This, in turn, complicates how we are going to understand the list of returnees in Ezra 2. Did these some 42,000 people, however accurate that number, return with Sheshbazzar or with Zerubbabel? The ambiguity, I think, is deliberate. I think that the historian had this list of returnees and did not know with whom to associate it, so he stuck it between the two separate historical events. My own suspicion is that the return under Sheshbazzar was relatively modest and not particularly successful. He was not able to do more than to begin to build the foundations of the temple, which would, for all intents and purposes, crumble by the time of the second emigration. The larger emigration, and 42,000 is almost certainly an exaggerated number, might have occurred 17 years later under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. Even more likely, the 42,000 refers to the number of people who returned over a longer period of time, perhaps over even a century or more. Whatever happened to Sheshbazzar, the second wave of returnees to Jerusalem occurred in 522 BCE. Incidentally, I should note that some scholars identify Sheshbazzar with Zerubbabel, but I don't really see good justification for that. Zerubbabel, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 19, was the grandson of Jehoiachin. The prophets refer to him as the branch, a reference that is meant to allude to his Davidic ancestry and the high, even messianic hopes that they had for him. According to Haggai, he, like Sheshbazzar, was appointed as a Persian governor of Yehud. Joshua is identified as the high priest, the son of Jehozadak. You might remember, if you have an exceptionally keen memory or are freakishly interested in this period, that I mentioned Jehozadak in the last episode. He was the high priest exiled with Jehoiachin. As they might say in Yiddish, these were two guys with serious yichus. If Sheshbazzar made any progress at all, you wouldn't know it. Zerubbabel and Joshua arrived in the seventh month. The Hebrew calendar in the Bible is reckoned from the month of Nisan. Today, it is reckoned from what would have been the seventh month, Tishrei. Ezra, chapter 3, verses 2 to 4, states, "Then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and his brother priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his brothers, set to and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings upon it, as it is written in the teaching of Moses, the man of God. They set up the altar on its site because they were in fear of the peoples of the land, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings each morning and evening. They then celebrated the festival of tabernacles, as it is written, with its daily burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings each morning and evening." This short passage reveals three significant details. First, there was no temple when they arrived. Indeed, there wasn't even an altar on which to offer sacrifices. Additionally, the fact that the first thing that they did was to set up the altar demonstrates that their understanding of the temple as the central feature of the worship of the God of Israel had not waned in the course of the exile. Second, though, they apparently did it so quickly in order to gain God's protection against these hostile people of the land. Who were these people? Most were undoubtedly the descendants of the Judahites, who were not exiled by the Babylonians. Some, of course, may have been non-Judahites, who had been resettled either as a result of Babylonian resettlement or voluntarily in Jerusalem. I think it more likely, though, that those Judahites who never left the area of Jerusalem felt particularly offended that these newcomers, who came with the backing of the king, were usurping them. I will return to this issue momentarily, but for now it is worth noting that this tension between those returning from Babylonia and those who never left is a central theme of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. The third intriguing detail of this short passage from Ezra is the reference to the Festival of Tabernacles, that is, the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. The mention of Sukkot is significant. Solomon dedicated the first temple on Sukkot, and the dedication of the second temple on the same holiday clearly is meant to connect the two temples and assert the legitimacy of the second. Indeed, a few hundred years later, the festival of Hanukkah, which literally means dedication and refers to the rededication of the temple, will be called the Festival of Sukkot in the month of Kislev. More interesting to me, though, is the omission of any mention of the two other holidays today celebrated in the seventh month, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It is not as if the returnees arrived too late in the month. According to verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to make burnt offerings to the Lord, although the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. I will return to this omission two episodes from now, when I discuss the redaction of the Torah and the documentary hypothesis. Here, I will just mention that some scholars think that it means that those two holidays were not yet in existence. It is, in any event, odd that they are entirely missing here. So the people began to build, but not for long. As soon as the rebuilding began, a group of local residents appealed to Zerubbabel. "Let us build with you, since we too worship your God, having offered sacrifices to him since the time of King Esarhaddon of Assyria, who brought us here." Zerubbabel and Joshua, though, wanted nothing to do with these townies, who may have also included those who returned 18 years earlier with Sheshbazzar, who are otherwise never heard from again. Why? After all, as I implied a few minutes ago, the desire on the part of the locals to join in building and worshiping at the temple is perfectly understandable. The locals saw themselves as part of the same religious community as the new returnees. But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the other elders did not see it that way. Something apparently happened in Babylonia. In truth, we don't know why Zerubbabel and Joshua so firmly rejected the help of the locals. As I will discuss in the next episode, though, we have a better idea about why Ezra, who led yet another return about 70 years later, continued to reject local help. Ezra, and probably Zerubbabel and Joshua before him, had adopted a kind of radical monotheism that was not common before. Additionally, this group, and I think that we can refer to them as belonging to an elite group or subgroup that formed out of the descendants of the Judahite exiles, saw itself as genealogically pure. Those who remained, on the other hand, were not. If this is all correct, there is, of course, an irony here. Those who went into exile, who learned to coexist well first in Babylonian and then Persian society, whose beliefs and modes of worship shifted the most, rejected the native inhabitants for not being pure enough. We might here see the emergence of a theme of intra-Jewish conflict that has run through Jewish history right to the present day. These locals, thoroughly annoyed now, set about undermining the work of rebuilding the temple. According to the authors of our histories, who were, of course, on the side of Zerubbabel and Joshua, these people of the land, the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, as they called them, bribed the Persian authorities to stop the work. They appear to have been largely successful. 2 years apparently passed with almost no progress on the temple. On the 24th day of the sixth month of the second year of the reign of Darius, 520 BCE now, the returnees began again to build. On the 21st day of the seventh month, that is, about a month later, the word of the Lord came to Haggai, and the message was not a pretty one. God rebukes the people for building their own houses before his house. As the prophecy continues, the reason for this neglect becomes clearer. There has been little rain, and things have not been going well for the returnees. You have sowed much, but brought in little. You eat without being satisfied. You drink without getting your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one gets warm. And he who earns anything earns it for a leaky purse, God says through Haggai. But the people, he goes on, have it all backwards. The drought, God declares, is the result, not the cause, of neglecting the rebuilding of the temple. Once the temple is rebuilt, God's favor will return and the land will prosper. About a month later, Zechariah began to prophesy. His prophecy included words of encouragement to Joshua and Zerubbabel. Joshua is compared to a brand plucked from the fire. Zerubbabel is my servant, the branch, referring again to the messianic figure from the Davidic line. To Zechariah, Zerubbabel was appointed by God. As he states in chapter 4, verses 8 to 10, and the word of the Lord came to me. Zerubbabel's hands have founded this house, and Zerubbabel's hands shall complete it. Then you shall know that it was the Lord of hosts who sent me to you. Does anyone scorn a day of small beginnings? When they see the stone of distinction in the hand of Zerubbabel, they shall rejoice. Yet another month passed, and then Haggai prophesied again. Now it appears that the foundation of the temple had been completed. Take note, God says through Haggai, from this day forward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day when the foundation was laid for the Lord's temple, take note while the seed is still in the granary, and the vine, fig tree, pomegranate, and olive tree have not yet borne fruit. For from this day on I will send blessings. That same day, Haggai confirms Zerubbabel as God's signet on the quickly approaching day of God's judgment. Why now? How do we imagine the social settings of these prophecies? We can only speculate, but then speculation is fun. My own guess would be that the building was not going well. Even with Haggai's help, it was hard for Zerubbabel and Joshua to motivate the people and marshal resources, especially after or during a drought and in the continuing face of local opposition. Zechariah added a bit more oomph, attempting to give even further authority to Zerubbabel and Joshua. Haggai then affirmed them yet again. Unlike Jeremiah, Haggai and Zechariah are company men, prophets who are working on the same side of the institutional leadership. The building project continued to face opposition. A Persian functionary named Tattenai was now governor of beyond the river, and he was alarmed by the construction of the temple. Maybe he was convinced by the locals to interfere. Maybe he suspected that their rebuilding project would somehow sow seeds of rebellion against Persia. We don't know. Tattenai, though, did his job diligently. Upon being informed by the leaders that they were acting in accordance with King Cyrus's decree, Tattenai allowed them to continue, as he wrote to Darius for confirmation. According to the book of Ezra, chapter 6, They searched the records in Babylonia and found King Cyrus's decree. This Aramaic decree goes well beyond the short Hebrew report found at the beginning of the book of Ezra. The document, if authentic at all, is almost certainly embellished, as is the document that follows, in which Darius confirms Cyrus's decree and guarantees Persian monetary support for the rebuilding of the temple and the sacrificial service. Thus reassured, Tatnai allows the building to continue. Assuming that Tatnai's intervention occurred close to the time that the foundation was completed, the temple took another 4 years to complete. The temple was completed on the 3rd of Adar in the 6th year of Darius's rule, 516 BCE. The celebration was raucous and bloody. The Israelites, the priests and the Levites, and all of the other exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy, and they sacrificed for the dedication of this house of God 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and 12 goats as a purification offering for all of Israel. The people also appointed priestly courses and Levitical divisions to take turns serving at the temple. A little over 5 weeks later, the exiles celebrated Passover at the new temple. The celebration included, and here I quote, "The children of Israel who had returned from the exile, together with all who joined them in separating themselves from the uncleanliness of the nations of the lands." The chapter of Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, and Joshua ends on this upbeat note. Ending their story with an account of this joyous Passover celebration highlights one of the major themes that I have discussed throughout this episode, that of continuity. Later Jews would come to see the Second Temple as a pale imitation of the first, and some scholars have seen this attitude in these late biblical writings. I don't really see this. What I see instead is a sincere belief that the Second Temple was fully authentic and would be just as good as, and even better than, the first. Notice of the Passover celebration was central in the accounts of the reforms of both Hezekiah and Josiah, the last two good pre-exilic Judahite kings. There were other continuities. Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, and Joshua all came from the right families. The prophets affirm God's support for the temple. Our sources repeatedly emphasize that the implements of the first temple, plundered by Nebuchadnezzar, were returned to be used in the second. In fact, a later tradition claims that even the very fire from the altar of the first temple was preserved and used in the second temple. According to Haggai's prophecy, God declares, "The glory of this later house shall be greater than the former one. The day of the Lord seemed to be at hand." But it wasn't. Zerubbabel and Joshua disappear from our sources just as Sheshbazzar did before them, and none of them exactly became household names. Haggai and Zechariah wrote before Zerubbabel and Joshua faded from the scene. Their predictions seem to have gone unfulfilled. Some 60 years after the Second Temple was completed, Ezra would lead yet another group from Babylonia to Jerusalem, and he would be shocked by what he found. Zerubbabel and Joshua faded from memory under the long shadow cast by Ezra, and it will be to Ezra that we will turn in the next episode. Israelite to Jew by Michael Sadlow. You can find more information about the podcast at www.mlsadlow.com on the blog and public education pages. I welcome your comments. The original original music is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Thank you for listening.